And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it never ceases to amaze me how our mainstream media lies and gets offended when somebody catches them. This business with Let's Go Brandon was a lie. That wasn't what the crowd was saying, but that's what a Wall Street Journal reporter said they were saying. And now that they've had to admit that they lied, oh, they're just terribly upset that anyone would doubt them. Well, today's October 26th, 299th day of the year. 66 days remain till the year's over with. This day in history, in 1185, the uprising of Ascion and Peter begins on the feast day of St. Demetrius of Thessalonica, ends with the creation of the Second Bulgarian Republic. 1341, the Byzantine Civil War of 1341 formally begins with the proclamation of John VI, Cantacuzinus, as Byzantine Emperor. Remember, Byzantium was actually originally the Eastern Roman Empire. 1377, Trevco I is crowned the first king of Bosnia. 1520, Charles V is crowned as the Holy Roman Emperor. The emperor of an empire that was not holy, wasn't Roman, but it rocked along for quite a number of years. 1597, the Imjin War. Grand Admiral Yi Sun Sen routs the Japanese navy of 300 ships with only 13 ships at the Battle of Myeongdong. 1640, the Treaty of Ripon is signed, restoring peace between Covenanter Scotland and King Charles. 1689, General Piccolomini of Austria burns down Skopje to prevent the spread of cholera. He died of that disease himself shortly after that. 1774, the First Continental Congress adjourns at Philadelphia. Unfortunately, for everybody concerned, it came back into session. 1813, War of 1812, a combined force of British regulars, Canadian militia, and Mohawks defeat the Americans in the Battle of Chateauguay. 1825, the Erie Canal opens, allowing direct passage from the Hudson River to Lake Erie. 1859, a Royal Charter storm kills at least 800 people in the British Isles. 1860, the expedition of 1,000 ends with Giuseppe Garibaldi presents his conquest to King Victor Emmanuel of Sardinia. 1863, the Football Association is founded. 1871, Liberian President Edward James Roy had deposed in a coup d'etat. Just had a coup d'etat in Sudan. Be interesting to see how that comes out. 1881, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday participate in a gunfight near the OK Corral in Tombstone. It was actually in a vacant lot. 1890, Malleco Viaduct in Chile, at the time the highest railroad bridge in the world, was inaugurated by President Jose Manuel Balmaceda. 1892, Ida B. Wells publishes Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. 1905, King Oscar II recognizes the dissolution of the union between Norway and Sweden. 1909, An Jung-gwin assassinates Japan's resident general of Korea. 1912, the First Balkan War. Ottomans lose the cities of Thessalonica and Skopje. 1917, World War I. Brazil declares war on the Central Powers. 1918, Erich Ludendorff, Quartermaster General of the Imperial German Army, is dismissed by Kaiser Wilhelm II for refusing to cooperate in peace negotiations. 1936, the first electric generator at Hoover Dam goes into full operation. 1942, World War II. And the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands during the Guadalcanal Campaign. One U.S. aircraft carrier sunk another is damaged, while two Japanese carriers and one cruiser are heavily damaged. 1944, World War II. The Battle of Leyte Gulf ends with an overwhelming American victory. Had we lost that battle, in all likelihood, the Japanese would have won the war. In 1947, Kashmir conflict. The Maharaja of Kashmir and Jammu signs the instrument of accession with India. 1955, after the last Allied troops had left the country and following the provisions of the Austrian Independence Treaty, Austria declares it will never join a military alliance again. 1955, Diao Dinh Diem proclaimed himself premier of the newly created Republic of Vietnam. 1956, Hungarian Revolution. In the town of Moson Magyarovar and Erzsgrom, Hungarian secret police forces massacre civilians. As the rebel strongholds in Budapest hold, fighting spreads throughout the country. 1958, Pan American Airways makes the first commercial flight of the Boeing 707 from New York City to Paris. 1967, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi crowns himself Emperor of Iran. 1968, the Soyuz 3 mission achieves the first Soviet space rendezvous. 1977, Ali Mawal Malin, the last natural case of smallpox, develops a rash in Somalia. The World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention consider this day to be the anniversary of the eradication of smallpox, the most spectacular success of vaccination. However, it has returned. 1979, Park Chung-hee, President of South Korea, is assassinated by Korean CIA head Kim Jong-un. 1985, the Australian government returns ownership of Uluru to the local Aborigines. 1989, China Airlines Flight 204 crashes after takeoff from Hualien Airport in Taiwan. All 54 people on board are killed. 1991, 3 months after the end of the 10-day war, the last soldier of the Yugoslav People's Army leaves the territory of the Republic of Slovenia. 1994, Jordan and Israel sign a peace treaty. 1995, Mossad agents assassinate Islamic Jihad leader Fatih Sakwaki in his hotel in Malta. Also in 95, an avalanche hits the Icelandic village Flateyri, destroys 29 homes and buries 45 people. 20 of those buried die. 1999, Britain's House of Lords votes to end the right of most hereditary peers to vote in Britain's upper chamber of parliament. 2000, a wave of protest forces Robert Goy to step down as president after the Ivorian presidential election. That was the Ivory Coast. 2001, the U.S. passes the Patriot Act. 2002, about 50 Chechen terrorists and 150 hostages die when Russian special forces troops storm a theater building in Moscow. It had been occupied by the terrorists during a musical performance 3 days before. 2003, the Cedar Fire, the third largest fire in California history, kills 15, consumes 250,000 acres, and destroys 2,200 homes around San Diego. 2015, a 7.5 magnitude earthquake strikes the Hindu Kush mountain range in South Asia, kills 399, leaves 2,536 people injured. And in 2017, at the level crossing of Hanko-Avinka railway line, a passenger train collides with an off-road truck at the Nyland Brigade in Rasberg, Finland. 4 are dead and 11 are injured. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Accession Day in Jammu and Kashmir, India. Angam Day in Nauru, Armed Forces Day in Benin, Christian Feast Days, Alfred the Great in the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and the Eastern Orthodox Church, Immediate through Strasbourg, Bielan of Mortlach, Blessed Celine Borzeka, said, Cuthbert of Canterbury, Demetrius of Thessalonica, Aedfrith of Leominster, Etta of Hexham, Pope Evaristus, Folk of Pavia in the Roman Catholic Church, Philip Nicolai, Johann Hermann, and Paul Gerhardt in the Lutheran Church, Quadragimus, Quadvotoi Dias, Rusticus of Narbonne, Witta of Brueberg, National Day, celebrates anniversary of the Declaration of Neutrality in 1955 in Austria. Okay, and it's Intersex Awareness Day. It's an internationally observed awareness day designed to highlight human rights issues faced by intersex people. Now, I'm not really sure what intersex people are, but it does fall under the category of human rights. But there's a lot of very strange people out there. Let's see what else we got. In 1850, Robert McClure cites the fabled Northwest Passage for the first time from Banks Island toward Melville Island. 1861, the Pony Express from Missouri to California ends after 19 months. 1863, International Conference begins in Geneva aiming at improving medical conditions on the battlefields. It's actually the beginning of what we know as the Red Cross. 1883, of smallpox I mentioned was discovered in Merkik District in Somalia. 2019, there was a raid by U.S. Special Forces that killed ISIS founder Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in Syria. On this day in 1984, The Terminator was released in the U.S. The famous birthdays, Jackie Coogan, who played Uncle Fester in The Munsters, born in 1914, died 1984. Hillary Clinton, the scourge of the earth, is 73. Seth MacFarlane is 47. This day in 1901 was the first recorded use of a getaway car in a holdup of a shop in Paris. On this day in 1963, Elizabeth Montgomery, who played Samantha Stevens in Bewitched, married director-producer William Asher in El Paso, of all places. Alfred the Great died on this day in 900. Hetty McDaniel, who played in Gone with the Wind, died in 1952 on this date. Sikorsky, who invented the Sikorsky, designed and built the Sikorsky helicopter, died on this day in 1972. Alrighty, let's see what else we've got. In 1954, Charles William Post was born on this date. He invented grape nuts, postum, and post toasties. On this day in 1858, H.E. Smith patented a rotary motion washing machine. 1942, the USS Hornet sunk in the Battle of Santa Cruz during World War II on this date. 1949, President Truman raised the minimum wage from 40 cents to 75 cents an hour. This day in 1951, Winston Churchill became Prime Minister of Great Britain. This day in 1955, The Village Voice was first published in New York City. 1957, on this date, the Soviet Union announced Defense Minister Marshal Georgi Zhukov had been relieved of his duties. 1970, Doonesbury, the comic strip by Gary Trudeau, premiered in 28 newspapers across the U.S., and everybody wondered how he could be Prime Minister of Canada and do a comic strip. 1972, Henry Kissinger, National Security Advisor, declared peace is at hand in Vietnam. 3 years later, everybody fell over themselves trying to get out of the country. 1977, experimental space shuttle Enterprise landed at Edwards Air Force Base in California. 1980, Israeli President Yitzhak Navon became the first Israeli head of state to visit Egypt. 1984, baby Faye was born. Well, she's given the heart of a baboon because she had a heart defect. Lived for 21 days after getting the heart transplant. 1988, Roussel Ouklaf, French pharmaceutical company, announced it was halting the worldwide distribution of RU486. That was a pill that would be that could be used to induce abortions. French government made the company reverse its position 2 days later. 1990, Wayne Gretzky, who's got a gorgeous daughter, became the first NHL player to reach 2,000 points. 1991, former Washington Mayor Marion Barry arrived at the Federal Correctional Institute in Petersburg, Virginia. He began serving a 6-month sentence for cocaine possession. 1994, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of Israel and Prime Minister Abdel Salam Mahali of Jordan signed a peace treaty. This day in 1996, federal prosecutors cleared Richard Jewell as a suspect in the Olympic Park bombing. He was the security guard who discovered the bomb, so a lot of rocket scientists decided he had planted the bomb. 1998, a French lab found a nerve agent on an Iraqi missile warhead. 1959, the first photos were seen on Earth of the far side of the moon when Luna 3, a Soviet satellite, sent the photos back to Earth via radio signals. 1933, the passenger carrying dirigible Graf Zeppelin stopped off on this date for a brief visit at Chicago, so the commander, Dr. Hugo Hechner, could attend the World's Fair. The ground crew consisted of 250 regular soldiers. The dirigible was 776 feet, and took 250 soldiers to get it in position so it could take off on its trip to Milwaukee. 1944, Harry Truman, while campaigning as Democratic vice presidential nominees, told reporters he never was, am not, never will be a member of the KKK. The Hungarian October Revolution was in its third day on this date, with demonstrators fighting in the streets of Budapest with Soviet troops. Estimates range from 3,000 to 5,000 dead, and many lying in the streets where they've fallen. New prime ministers appealing for calm. On this day in 1965, the Beatles are made members of the Order of the British Empire by the Queen. On this day in 1967, future U.S. Senator and presidential candidate John McCain, a U.S. Navy pilot in the Vietnam War, is shot down over North Vietnam. Spends the next 5.5 years in prison, two of which were spent in solitary confinement. And on this day in 2000, a report on bovine spongiform encephalopathy, commonly called mal cow disease, places the blame on many organizations and politicians for the spread and growth of what's known as BSE in its human form. They said the danger of the public wasn't identified quickly enough. The government didn't inform the public quickly enough. Recycling animal protein and feed was the main cause of the spread of the disease. And everyone is more concerned about the damage to the beef industry than they were about the fact that mad cow disease could affect humans. Well, you know, the interesting thing about what's going on in the world today is the system seems to be eating itself. And that's extremely unfortunate. Because, you know, in the 21st century, you would think we'd be much further ahead, but instead we spend our time reinventing the wheel. We've got people being crucified over things they said 30 years ago, instead of it being looked at what they're saying today. Well, we're going to talk about another Hollywood scandal today. The Choi Ling Foo Dance Troupe. The day was February 24th, 1923. And they were appearing at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood. And they were late appearing. And the audience sat while the orchestra played the intro music over and over. But unfortunately, for some of them, the curtain will never rise again. Now, there were five members of the troupe, a fire eater, a contortionist, a plate spinner, a knife thrower, and one that hangs by his hair. They originated in China. The act traveled the world for 7 years, entertaining audiences in what they called their mystic show, before finally settling in New York to concentrate in the U.S. And one member of the troupe, Choi Den, was the fire eater and the acknowledged boss of the show. His cousin, Choi Yu Chung, was the contortionist. Choi Den was proud of what they'd achieved with the troupe and spent hours refining the show and organizing rehearsals. Choi Yu Chung was getting tired of the constant traveling and entertaining and wanted to leave the show. Now, Choi Den was not a fan of his cousin leaving and persuaded Choi Yu to carry on regardless, though as an act of rebellion,
He got into the habit of not only being late for rehearsals, but late for his entire approach to the show. Now, this unprofessionalism was causing a lot of dissension within the ranks. And Choi Den felt it was on his shoulders to take things in hand. He was frequently seen berating his cousin for the lack of concern he was showing for everybody. Unfortunately, his demanding nature was to have tragic and dramatic consequences for Choi Den. His cousin didn't really take kindly to being told what to do. And he was fed up. On the evening of February 24th, four members of the troupe went through their daily rehearsals before getting ready to take to the stage at the Pantages. But Choi Yu, as he was referred to, was nowhere to be seen, and his absence was noted by everybody, but particularly Choi Den. As he had done before, he became frantic that as a result of the missed rehearsal, the show was going to suffer. So Choi Den sat on a trunk in a dressing room and complained bitterly to the other members about his cousin. Man complained for some time before Choi Yu finally arrived, unprepared, unrehearsed, and in no mood to go on stage. Choi Den was incensed and started lecturing him about the lack of professionalism he was showing, not only to himself, but to the other members of the troupe. But this time the argument was a little different. It was more intense, and it became quite heated. In fact, the fight grew so bitter it spilled out of the dressing room into the passage beneath the stage, completely unknown to the audience who were still waiting in the auditorium, wondering when the show was going to start. So the shouting became so heated, the other troop members decided to take cover, knowing that Choi Den was just out of his mind with anger at his cousin. Finally, Choi Den pulled a pistol out of his pocket and shot Choi Yu through the heart. Everybody was just stunned. They couldn't believe what they'd just seen. And before anybody could do anything, Choi Den turned a gun on himself and shot himself in the head. Now, the bullet didn't kill him immediately. It took several days for the man to finally die from his injuries. But to say the other members were disturbed by the evening's events would be something of an understatement. The auditorium was immediately emptied and people spilled out onto the pavement wondering what the hell happened. Everybody heard the gunshots. Nobody knew what they were about. Now, rumors were rife, but nobody knew exactly what had gone on until they read about it in the paper a few days later, which caused a great deal of discussion and intrigue at the breakfast table of those who had been at the performance. Now, it was never discovered if the shooting had been a heat of the moment decision by Choi Den or if he'd planned it as he sat fuming in the theater dressing room that night. Had he taken the gun with him to shoot his cousin, or did he always carry the gun? And was it just sheer rage that caused him to pull it out and shoot his cousin? Well, certainly, there's no question both men been pushed to their limit. Both wanted different things from their careers, and neither one knew precisely how to change the situation until the argument put an end to all possibilities. Now, the remaining members of the troupe decided to cancel the show and return home to China. But various members of their entourage put a stop to these plans by telling them that'd be against their principles and culture to just give up on all they'd achieved. Regardless of how they felt, they were told to release a statement which said they'd undergone a change of heart of going without Choi Yu and Choi Den after all. Meanwhile, at the family home in New York, Choi Yu's parents got a telegram about what had happened and refused to believe he was dead. They asked, "Are we then fools to place our faith in the mutterings of a devil that speaks through a thin wire?" Well, they responded they're going to have to see the body to confirm for themselves that he was dead. So as requested, the body was taken to New York, accompanied by a representative of the Choi Ling Fu troupe, who announced his intention to search for Choi Yu's nearest heir. If the heir was found, he would be drafted to join the troupe, no matter what he felt about the subject. From California, the remaining troop made the bizarre decision to announce it was the heir's hereditary right to take over, regardless of opinion, desire, or ability. And it was, of course, something of an ironic decision, since the reason for the death of the original members had been because of Choi Yu's less than enthusiastic longing to be part of the show. Well, the troop seems to have disappeared shortly after the scandal that took over their 1923 show, and wasn't known if an heir was found, willing or otherwise. Nobody really knew what happened. Well, our next little scandal deals with Norman Kidd McCoy Selby. Now, some Hollywood scandals involve full-time actors and actresses, and others involve those who become famous in another area only to find Hollywood stardom intruding into their lives. But this next scandal involved Norman Selby, the boxer who had almost as many wives as boxing championships. Now, Norman Selby was born in Moscow, Indiana, October 13th, 1872, and he went on to become an American world champion boxer. He won no less than 81 times with 55 knockouts. He was a legendary middleweight fighter who turned his attention to acting. Appeared in a variety of films in the early days of Hollywood. But his life out of the ring was far more colorful than the one he had in it. And he became something of a joke in the newspapers with his serial marriages, as they were called. By 1920, he had been married 7 times to 5 different women, and was about to marry Carmen Browder, also known as Dagmar Dahlgren, which would make 8 marriages. Newspapers called him the undisputed marrying champion of America, although he was adamant his latest indulgence would be the last time down the aisle for him. He said, "I've been doing this since 1895. I feel entitled to retire from active marrying, although, of course, I'll always retain an interest in the game." His reason for divorcing was, according to him, he kept forgetting his wedding anniversary. Well, he married Browder April 19, 1920, and by September 5th that year, she'd filed for divorce. According to the 20-year-old dancer, her 47-year-old husband had treated her with an extreme cruelty, was abusive and violent, and had stayed out all night just 3 days after the wedding. During divorce proceedings, Browder's friend, Francis LeBurthen, said she had seen scars on the dancer's body. Result, she said, of spurning Selby's excessive lovemaking. The disturbing story was that the two had lived as man and wife for just 2 weeks before Browder woke one night to find Selby forcing himself on her. When she refused him, he threw his wife out of the bed and hit her. When Browder told the court that she believed Selby when he told her he wanted a real girl he could love, Judge Jackson wouldn't believe his ears. After 7 previous marriages, didn't she suspect there must be something wrong with him? And she said, "No, I didn't." Then the judge said, "You still believe you wanted a real girl to love?" And Browder shook her head and said, "Well, no." So the judge granted the decree, but not before expressing his doubts about the serial marriage habit of Selby. He said, "If I grant this decree, this man's going to get another wife. This girl might as well act as a buffer for the rest of the community." Well, in September 1922, Selby announced his intention to marry 24-year-old Jacqueline McDowell, who traveled to L.A. specifically to marry the undisputed male vamp, as the newspapers were calling him. After much hilarity, while being turned down for a marriage license due to the absence of the bride-to-be, the two were eventually granted permission to marry and posed happily for cameramen. Well, fortunately for McDowell, she discovered Selby had been seeing another woman just days before the wedding. So, that gave her an excuse to call off the nuptials. He spent the next few years in and out of newspapers, filed for bankruptcy, and had several brushes with the law, including being investigated by police for firing a gun in the bathroom of his apartment on South Calendar Street in Los Angeles. But in August of 1924, the scandalous life came to a head when he became the prime suspect in the murder of his married girlfriend, Teresa Moores. Living as Mr. and Miss Shields, Norman and Teresa stayed together in an apartment at 2819 Leeward Avenue. That's where Selby told friends he loved his girlfriend more than he'd ever loved any woman before. But the affair wasn't a quiet one, as you might guess. And although Moores was in the process of divorcing her husband, there were numerous fights about an antique shop they both shared. And the relationship between Moores and Selby was also volatile. Moore's friend, Ann Shapp, who owned the shop next door to the antique store, tried to persuade Teresa to leave the box on more than one occasion. But this didn't prove to be a sensible thing to do. On one particular evening, Shelby approached Shapp and insulted her. And it became clear to both Shapp and her husband that Selby knew all about the talks they had with Moores about leaving the relationship. So they decided they had to be on their guard. August 12th, things took a disastrous turn when Teresa Moores was found shot dead in her and Selby's apartment. Determined not to be blamed for her death, Selby insisted he had wanted to marry the woman and he'd never be happy without her. He told police they'd been for a drive and came back home when Moores went down, became downhearted over trouble in the antique shop. Well, according to Selby, she suddenly declared she's going to end it all, grabbed a knife, and tried stabbing herself with it. Well, when that didn't work, she took out a pistol. Despite his attempts to stop her, she committed suicide right in front of him. Bizarrely, at that point, Selby said he covered it with a blanket, washed the dishes, and headed out to kill Albert Moores, Teresa's estranged husband. He blamed the husband for her committing suicide. In a violent rage, Selby reached Moore's home, where he was told by the maid that he wasn't in residence that evening. He left, going around hotels in a vain attempt to find him, and in the early morning went to the antique shop to confront his rival. When Moores wasn't present at the store, Selby encountered a shop full of customers and staff, robbed them, and forced some of the men to remove their trousers so they couldn't escape. One man tried to leave and was shot by Selby before he turned his attention to Mr. and Ms. Shapp, who lived in the shop, who owned the shop next door. Well, police asked him why he'd do such a thing as hold up a store full of customers and then shoot the neighbors, and Selby claimed it was all done to avenge his girlfriend's death. He said, "My lights went out when I saw Teresa dead at my feet." Well, police descended on his apartment where they found the place in utter disarray. A copy of his will was on the table, along with liquor bottles. Didn't take them long to decide Selby'd been the one to actually kill his girlfriend. They also believed he'd left the will on the table as he intended to kill himself after he'd shot Teresa's husband. "If I'd have caught him at home, I'd have killed him and killed myself," he told the officers. "Now, there's no doubt in our minds McCoy killed Teresa Moore," according to police. There were some doubts in the jury's mind, though, and after seeing Selby demonstrate a dramatic reenactment of his girlfriend's last moments, as well as the surprise appearance of ex-wife Dagmar Dahlgren, they remained split on between first-degree murder and acquittal. Finally, Selby was convicted of manslaughter and stayed in prison until 1932. When he left, he told reporters, "I'm through with the prize ring, the matrimonial ring, and the ring of ice and glasses." He left for Michigan and took a job with the Ford Motor Company. Well, in spite of his protesting, he wasn't quite finished with women. In 1937, he married Sue Cobb Cowley. Unfortunately, the new start he'd hoped for in Michigan was never a peaceful one, and eventually on April 18, 1940, he decided to end his life in the Hotel Tuller in Detroit. He took a fatal overdose and then sat down to write a short note. "To all my dear friends, I wish you the best of luck. I'm sorry I couldn't endure this world's madness." Then he signed it, "My very best to you all, Norman Selby." Well, there are numerous stories along those lines of folks who had a connection with Hollywood decided to take that way out. This next story deals with Rusell Rixon, known as the adult child star. Now, it's always sad when somebody dies young, no matter who they are, but the tale of Lucille Rixon's unusually distressing, since at the time of her death, she'd barely reached puberty. But she'd been acting as an adult for some years prior to her passing. Now, Hollywood is a land of make-believe. There's no question about that. Of fairy tales and glamour, but for Lucille, it was the stuff of nightmares. And it broke up her family and cost her her life. Born as Ingeborg Erickson in Chicago, Illinois, August 22nd. Most likely 1910, though her actual birth year is something of a mystery. Almost from the day she was born, Lucille was working in the industry. First as a baby model, and then by age 5, she was an actress. Some of the photographs she posed for were cute and showed the smiling Lucille sporting ringlets in her hair. And some of the others are, well, let's just say a little less appealing. At age 5, she started posing provocatively next to a window, a lace scarf being the only thing covering her body. Now, how or why this disturbing photo was ever taken is something of a mystery, but it shows the shape of things as the girl got older and moved into her movie career. By the time she was 8, the pressures of running Lucille's career in a home become extremely tiring for her mother, whose name was also Ingeborg. Normally, one would expect if a child's career is getting in the way of the family, the mother would probably scale back the amount of work she had, but not Ingeborg. She was one of the first real showbiz mothers. And instead of taking her daughter away from the camera, she decided the best thing to do would be divorce her husband, leave Chicago, and move herself and her 2 children to Hollywood, where she planned for Lucille to be more successful and even busier than ever before, and put money in Mama's pocket. Now, it wasn't known if Lucille was happy with this situation, but we do know that once in the city, the young girl's career took off in a big way. Her name was changed to Lucille Rixon, and she was chosen by producer Samuel Golden to appear in a series of comedy shorts. The titles were Edgar's Hamlet, Edgar Camps Out, and Edgar the Explorer. These films ran from 1920 to 21 before there came the chance not only to act in the future, but to work alongside her brother Marshall. When she was cast in The Old Nest, a film based on a story written by Rupert Hughes, the uncle of Howard Hughes. Now, Lucille impressed everybody with whom she worked. She had the opportunity of not only working with Rupert again several years later, but became extremely good friends as well. She was also a hit with movie fans, went off on tour of the country, chatting to children, appearing in theaters, and attending celebrity events. She had enjoyed the attention and the work, and as a result, recorded her news meticulously in her scrapbook whenever she had a spare minute. She was living a lovely fairy tale dream. She was busy and her childhood wasn't like that of other children, but she was having fun anyway and making a hell of a lot of money. As she turned 12, her work on camera began to change, and the studio altered her image from that of a cutie ringlet-wearing kid to a sophisticated adult player. She was cast in films such as Human Wreckage in 1923, a film about drug addiction, and allowed her to play the sweetheart role in The Judgment of the Storm in 1923. In February 23, the Covington Republic newspaper called Lucille the youngest leading lady on the screen. Described her as having big brown eyes and a wealth of blonde hair. They even put her real age in the article. She was 12 at the time. In an attempt to make it more acceptable, she was now being offered grown-up roles. The studio had to make her a full-fledged woman. Before she knew it, they were saying she was 16. But in actual fact, she was not quite 13. Disturbingly, the studio didn't seem to see anything wrong with this and would often cast her as the devoted but excessively jealous young wife alongside older stars. In one particular film, she was even cast as a young woman who's beaten up and generally abused by her bully of a husband. And on the cover of Picture Play magazine, she appeared wearing a large hat with her bare shoulder, arm, and some of her back visible. Now, the wrong signals are clearly being given out, and with so many fully fledged adult actresses and models around, there was, of course, no need to use a child in a grown-up role. The reason the studio insisted on doing it remains a mystery, and it's equally concerning that it appears that at no time did her mother step in and tell the studios Lucille's far too young to make such dramatic roles. Well, the leap from child actress to adult at the age of 12 had a lasting effect on Lucille, and it's clear the types of parts being given to her only succeeded in priming this young lady for all sorts of disturbing real-life situations. It's interesting to note that at this point in time, Lucille stopped cutting out and collecting her newspaper clippings in her scrapbook, and now began tearing the pages out and throwing them into the scrapbook. Something had changed, both on and off camera. And for young Lucille, the glamour had ceased and her life would never be the same again. If anybody had the least bit of concern for the child actress, nobody seemed to come forward to say so. Any adult roles and scripts continued to arrive in her door. Tragically, she seemed to have developed a succession of crushes on her co-stars during this time, which possibly were even reciprocated, although the actors in question knew Lucille wouldn't yet pass the age of consent. Case in point, an announcement in the pages of the Billboard that said Lucille had married actor Sidney Chaplin in the autumn of 1923. Now, considering her age, this was absurd, and there's no proof that it actually happened, especially since no official comment was ever made about the marriage, and after the announcement, there was never any mention of it again. Still, Billboard had to have some reason to believe the 13-year-old actress was marrying 38-year-old Chaplin. The two must surely have been close enough for people to think they could have been an item, and Lucille herself once told an interviewer that while working together, they had a perfectly screaming time. Well, by the time 1924 rolled around, the child actress was being put into one film after another and working long, hard hours at the studio. After completing no fewer than 10 films in 7 months, she was exhausted and in need of a rest, but Hollywood kept calling and insisting she work. Sadly, this was the beginning of the end for this young lady. She couldn't handle any more of the grueling schedule been thrust on her since the day she was born. As a result of exhaustion, she collapsed and was confined to bed at home, where her mother kept a vigil and vowed to keep the studio newspapers away from her daughter until she was better. Well, the story of her breakdown was eventually leaked, and it fell to her doctor, J.F. McKittrick, to announce exactly what he believed to be wrong with her. He said that she crowded too much work into too short a time and overtaxed her capabilities. Result is she's had a complete physical and nervous collapse. So complete she hadn't rallied from it as she should. Lying in her bedroom, or as she called it, her sunshine room, she enjoyed receiving visitors such as her brother Marshall and actress Lois Wilson. Unfortunately, in spite of everyone's efforts, she grew worse and worse, and in February 1925, things took a tragic turn when her mother collapsed in Lucille's bedroom, died in front of her. Shock of this tragic event was too much for the child to bear, and after several days, she went into a coma from which she never recovered. Well, with their father not living with the children and her mother now dead, it was decided family friend, actor Conrad Nagel, and producer and author Rupert Hughes would become the children's guardians. This arrangement didn't last long, though. March 13, 1925, Lucille Rickson died, according to the newspapers, the victim of a broken heart. Her death certificate stated the girl died from pulmonary tuberculosis, though sadly this hadn't stopped disturbing rumors that her breakdown, illness, and death were all really the results of a botched abortion undertaken shortly before her initial collapse. Of course, no newspaper reported such a thing at the time, and instead they were full of articles and tributes from many of Lucille's co-stars and friends. Flowers flooded the home, and a simple but impressive funeral was planned at the Gates, Crane, and Earl Chapel, where Lucille's memorial was to take place. On the day of the funeral itself, the venue was full of celebrities who had known or worked with Rusile. Flowers from Mary Pickford, Sidney Chaplin, Rupert Hughes, and Lois Wilson surrounded the coffin. Many others lay an anonymous tribute around the church. In accordance with their wishes, Lucille Rixon's body was cremated, and both her ashes and those of her mother's were interred at Forest Lawn Memorial Park. Now, days later came the news that while still only a teenager, Lucille Rixon left an estate of $50,000 in the form of life insurance and $10,000 in personal property. It shocked everybody. She was relatively poor at the time of her death. In fact, Hollywood producer Paul Byrne had stepped in to pay for her nursing care. Tragically, it would seem the child was now worth more in death than she'd been in life. And her father, Samuel, was all set to inherit it all. Although she hadn't lived with him since she was eight, Samuel Erickson had recently moved to L.A., presumably to be close to his children. After losing his ex-wife and in Lucille, the man had had enough of the so-called bright lights of Hollywood and was intent on getting custody of his 18-year-old son, Marshall, who was still under the care of Rupert Hughes and Conrad Nagel. Samuel greatly distrusted the two men. Of course, he wanted his hands on the money, and he made it clear to Marshall they only wanted him to give up his acting career and concentrate on his education instead. To that end, he decided to use the majority of his inheritance from Lucille for the education of his son, but first he'd have to get custody. Helping his quest, he hired a lawyer, Griffin Jones, who told reporters that Samuel Erickson had objected to his children being associated with older people within the movie industry. And he proved himself to be an extremely kind and loving parent, intensely interested in the welfare of his children. Both Hughes and Nagel were surprised at these developments, and Hughes released a statement as to why they had become guardians in the first place. It said, Mr. Nagel and I were named in the petition with the full consent of the father. We were actuated by sympathy and a wish to help children in their difficulties. I've had no information Mr. Erickson desired to enter a protest our guardianship. But protest he did. Citing the fact the guardianship had been legally sworn as Lucille had died before it could be heard. The custody case for Marshall Erickson went to court April 16, 1925, with Samuel Erickson's main charge being that Rupert Hughes was not a suitable guardian, since he had written a piece for the publication entitled Why I'm Going to Quit the Church. In the article, Hughes had said anybody believed in the Bible and either never read it or was actually lying. Erickson took offense to this, stating that Hughes must obviously be an atheist and therefore an unsuitable candidate for looking after a teenage boy. Well, he didn't bank on a revelation from Hughes himself, who told the court that before Lucille's death, both she and Marshall had summoned him to their home and begged him and Nagel to take charge of their affairs to protect them from their father. You know, Erickson was obviously shocked to hear about this, but it was enough to swing the vote in Hughes's favor, and Judge J. Perry Wood gave him and Nagel joint custody of Marshall Wixon. During the coming years, the boy was given emotional support from the two men. He went on to attend university and became a lawyer. He never spoke about his early life in Hollywood or his sister. His father, Samuel, tragically passed away April 25, 1928. Just 3 years after his ex-wife and daughter. Now, according to the LA Times, Lucille had an enthusiasm as strong as her frame was slight, gave everything to her career and lost her life and family to the trappings of Hollywood. Well, the exact circumstances surrounding her death will never be known, but for one thing is sure, if she'd just been allowed to be a child instead of an adult at the age of 12, she would have been much happier. Well, you know, there have been accusations, I guess you could say, about this one being murdered and that being murdered. And it's been said there's never been anything like a perfect murder, but there's an almost perfect murder that comes out of Hollywood. It came The story came out in a Hollywood court case that took place 1927. It's been forgotten primarily because it never really grabbed the public's attention. In 1927, Paul Kelly was an up-and-coming actor described by the media as dashing and debonair. Born August 9, 1899 in Brooklyn, his career began as a child actor at age 7. Became a big star with the Vitagraph Studios. Unlike many actors since that time, he made the transition from child actor to leading man successfully and went on to star on the New York stage in plays such as 17 and Whispering Wires. And because of his good looks and talent, Hollywood came knocking on his door. And it wasn't long before he was working at Paramount. He played in 1926's New Klondike and movie Special Delivery in 1927. So by March of that year, the gossip columnists were announcing the news that this hot young actor was destined for huge success and that Warner Brothers were going to sign him for their next picture, about to become one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. Well, unfortunately, nobody could predict what was going to happen next. Ray Raymond was a stage actor and singer who in 1927 had been married to actress Dorothy McKay for 7 years, having met her in New York when they were both appearing in a production called Blue Eyes. Together, they lived and worked in New York and Hollywood and welcomed the arrival of their daughter, Valeria, who in 1927 was 4 years old. However, by all accounts, the marriage wasn't exactly a happy one, and this was confirmed by McKay herself. A letter said, I know it's not right for me to say, but he was unkind to me. He was always accusing me of being involved with Paul Kelly, but his accusations were untrue. The accusations involved the actress stemmed from a friendship that begun in New York long before Dorothy met Raymond. And the two stayed in contact over the years, but while she claimed it was platonic, Raymond was convinced they were having an passionate affair, and he forbid his wife from seeing the actor anymore. Well, Raymond was shocked when his wife refused to give up her friendship and blatantly continued to see him with the full knowledge of her husband. Well, her refusal to cool her association with Kelly didn't go down well with Raymond. Particularly when it was rumored the actor had asked Dorothy to divorce her husband and marry him instead. McKay laughed it off and declared if there had been any talk of marriage with Kelly, it was purely a joke, although she did admit her marriage to Raymond had been under strain. Well, interesting thing, like so many Hollywood marriages, rumor and innuendo carried more weight than did truth. Well, alcohol certainly played a large part in this fiasco. There's a lot more to it, but we've run out of time. And we'll be back tomorrow and finish talking about this almost perfect murder. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.